Welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today, Jordan, we are helping people tackle a notoriously difficult challenge.
That's right. It's a challenge made even more difficult by the information age, by the pandemic, and, you know, by some people just sucking.
That's right. We're talking about dating. And here to help us with that challenge is behavioral scientist Logan Urie.
People are often wrong about what will make them happy long term. And we think we have preferences, but those preferences are more fungible than we think. And so part of the work that I do is actually helping people understand that they should throw out the checklist and focus on different things.
Logan is a dating coach and the director of relationship science at Hinge. Her new book, How to Not Die Alone, The Surprising Science That Will Help You Find Love, is all about how we're dating wrong and what we can do to fix our approach to find lasting love.
So Jordan, here's the thing about me.
Tell me.
I'm super old. here's how old I am.
Tell me.
When I was last dating, caller ID did not exist.
What?
Which meant you could conceivably, if somebody ghosted you, you could prank them. Which I did.
Tell me a prank that you did on a date.
Not a good prank. It was like, you know, my friends came over and we got drunk and they like pretended to be horny and calling was just not nothing like. There was no clever line.
I can't get revenge the same way these days with like caller
ID. You can't
ID
do it. That's like kids these days. You can't
you
have
know,
fun.
Technology has ruined.
Where did the fun go?
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I will say that if I had been ghosted by someone and I could see him on social media, I think my brain would break. I can't imagine what that feels like.
Man, I'm trying to think of if I've been ghosted, like sincerely ghosted.
Or even just dating somebody, you know, just like if you're like starting out and then like you see them and then they're like,
well, that's the weird thing for me in the pandemic. So some context here. I am what we can consider at risk for dying alone. So since I am in this, I'm in my mid 30s, I'm unmarried, all of that stuff. So I am who, you know, a grandmother would be very concerned about. And in the pandemic right now, the only places that I would be able to meet people if I were interested in meeting people and dating are all places that I frequent regularly and wouldn't want to ruin. So like I go to the dog park a lot, for example. I have Lily. I go to the park every morning. I'm there. There's people there who I would meet, but I would hate to date someone at the dog park because I would be worried about the awkwardness that would happen afterwards. There's no like separation between, you know, if you meet someone in a bar, you meet someone on a trip, or you meet someone at a festival or whatever, you very well might not see that person again, or you can have a clean break. But like, I only operate within a 1 mile orbit of my home. So like anyone who I were to date organically or anyone who I were to date, you know, by serendipity would be someone who I would cross paths with in the future and have that problem.
So you'll have to like, you know, just start to go to dog parks far away from your home to find love.
I
and if people ask you why you're
option.
There, you'll say, I'm here to find love.
This is why I'm here. I am here. Lily, go scope someone out. Go talk to someone.
Lily, daddy doesn't want to die alone.
And then she would look at me with her like puppy dog eyes and think, but what about me? What about me? That's the voice that I hear from Lily. What about me?
If you die, she's screwed. So
that's my, okay. So when it comes to dying alone, this is, I think you and I have had this conversation before. My fear is like loose ends. So like, what if I have an appointment and I accidentally stand someone up because I'm dead? And then my other fear is, what if I die in my apartment? I live alone in New York City and my dog would just have to go to the bathroom and she wouldn't be able to go to the bathroom and she would feel so terrible because I can't take her out. And meanwhile, I'm dead and Lily's just so sad because she just really needs to pee and she's starving. This is my greatest fear about dying alone.
Wow. Well, we might have gotten a little bit off track, but the things you're concerned about are not things I would be concerned about because number one, you weren't missing appointments, and also your dog is just going to pee. Your dog's not going to just going to be concerned for like a half an hour, and they're just going to be like, fuck this. I'm peeing in the corner.
Listen, I need Logan to help me solve this specifically, not for myself, but for Lily.
All right, let's get it worked out. Logan, welcome to The Upgrade.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about your job as Director of Relationship Science. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so I work at the dating app Hinge, and I help lead a research team. And we are all about studying how do people get into successful relationships from Hinge? Then how can we use that information to teach other people how to do it? And so our tagline is designed to be deleted. And we actually are really focused on helping people get off the app, onto great dates, and hopefully into really happy relationships.
Are there any secrets from that data that you can share with us? Like what's some characteristics of really successful online daters or really bad online daters? Like what's a common sort of thread there that might surprise me?
Yeah, so I joined last March, and my first week was actually the week that the pandemic really hit New York, and Hinge is based in New York. And so a lot of our research so far has been studying dating during the pandemic. And so some really interesting stats around video chat. And one that I can share with you is that a third of people said that they would define the relationship or DTR with someone who they had only met online. And that number was even higher for men. So 43% of men said that they would get into an exclusive relationship with someone they'd only met online.
What? That seems ridiculously high.
There we go. I mean, I think that people are just willing to be more open-minded right now about certain things. And I think that there's just such a natural human need for connection and, you know, relationships and partnerships that people are really redefining what it means to be connected at this time. But yeah, it surprised me too.
You know, unlike Jordan, I'm not a cynic and I believe that people want to connect. That's just my own.
Me, on the other hand, I'm just like, so does that mean that everyone should just lower their standards? Is that what we're all doing here? 97% of people said that after one date, they would get married.
So Logan, one of our favorite chapters in your book is called Fuck the Spark, in which you vehemently refute the idea that people should only continue dating if they feel that initial spark. Why is that? Why is looking for that spark a bad thing?
That's also probably my favorite chapter, or it's certainly the one that seems to have taken off. I think maybe it's just really fun to say fuck the spark, and I like to chant it. Maybe we can all chant it together at the end. But yeah, so in my work as a dating coach, I found that people would go on dates and they would describe the date and they'd say, I had a really good time and he was amazing and we did this fun thing, but I'm not going to see him again. I would just be so confused. And I would say, what are you talking about? And they'd say, oh, I just didn't feel the spark. And so the spark has sort of become this catch-all term that people use to mean this immediate pang, this immediate excitement. And people get so wrapped up in this Disney fairy tale experience of two people, you know, reaching for the tomato at the same time in the farmer's market. And really this meet cute from rom-coms. And they're so focused on what they think love will feel like, what they think dating is all about, that it really leads them astray. And I like to say that the spark has become my nemesis. And there's three main myths about the spark that I debunk in the book. The first one is that the spark can't grow over time. You either have it or you don't. And the research shows that that's absolutely not true. A lot of successful, happy couples say that they didn't feel love at first sight. Only 11% of people say that that happened to them. And we know that the research supports the idea that people can grow on you over time. There's something called the mere exposure effect. The more that you are around someone or something, often the more you like it. That's why people who meet someone at work and don't feel that special spark, they end up marrying that person later. This also happens with housemates or roommates. The second myth is that if you feel the spark, it's a good thing. And that's definitely not true. So some people are just really sparky. They just give that pang of excitement to a lot of people. And maybe this is because they're really attractive. Maybe because it's very charming. We also see that it's sometimes because they're narcissistic and they're very focused on making someone like them. And the research on attachment theory shows that sometimes people confuse anxiety for chemistry. And so what's actually going on is you're like, will he call me back? Will he not? And that feeling of excitement is really not something you should be optimizing for. It's actually a sign that someone's just not making you feel clear on how they feel about you. And the last one is that if you have the spark, then it's going to be a viable relationship. And so it might sound surprising, but a lot of couples stay together for the how we met story, or they think it was so romantic that we're meant to be. This is clearly my soulmate. But who cares how you met? It's 0.01% of your relationship, right? Who cares if you met on an app or you met in this romantic, you know, airplane, he switched seats to sit next to me, right? That doesn't really determine the longevity or success of your relationship. And so my advice in the book is to fuck the spark and instead go for the slow burn. And those are the people who get better over time. They might not be the most initially charming, but they make great long-term partners, and you actually have to keep an open mind, and you sometimes have to go on a second and third date to identify them. But these people often make the best long-term partners. Mm.
I have to say, every time I've had that spark, it was disastrous. To the point where when I got that feeling, I was like, run away.
Because
this person is definitely a sociopath. Like, something's going on. They're pulling a number on me, because it never worked out. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah, that's true. And I forgot to say this, but it's true. It's a lot of divorced couples had the spark. It doesn't mean anything about long term. It means like what dynamic emerged when the two of you were together that first time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like the goal is long-term partnership. And if the goal is long-term partnership, what types of things should someone look for in a first date or those early dates that might signal to them that they're a good fit?
Yeah. So, right. The spark is something that people overly optimize for. And we just explained why you shouldn't do that. The other mistake that I see people making is they have this idea of the checklist, right? And so people come into my office as a dating coach and they say, I want a 6'4" businessman who has these qualities and makes this amount of money per year. And I'm very clear about what I want. I just need your help finding him. And a lot of my work is actually helping people shift their mindset and do more of dating like a scientist and actually have a more open mind. And the idea here is that in behavioral science, which is the frame of the book, people are often wrong about what will make them happy long term. And we think we have preferences, but those preferences are more fungible than we think. And so part of the work that I do is actually helping people understand that they should throw out the checklist and focus on different things. And so one of the chapters of the book is about what matters more and less than we think for long-term relationships. And so in the category of matters less than we think, two of the things are attraction and money. And look, those things do matter to some extent, but why they matter less than we think is because of something called adaptation. Whatever we have, we get used to, right? I'm sure you probably know this research about lottery winners, that when you imagine how happy a lottery winner is, you think that they're going to be ecstatic for the rest of their life. But that's just not true, because at a certain point, you get used to being a lottery winner, you pay less attention to the money, and you just sort of go back to your original baseline happiness. And so with looks and money, you adapt to it over time. The other two are similar personalities and shared hobbies. And so sometimes I'll have a dating coaching client who says, I love to party. I like to go out until 2 or 3 a.m. And my girlfriend, she's a homebody. And wouldn't I be happier with someone who would go out with me? And I turn to them and I say, no, you are way too much as it is. Imagine two of you in a relationship. That just sounds exhausting. And your girlfriend compliments you. And this is a great relationship. And this grounds you. And you don't need to have your personality twin. And there's no research suggesting that that matters. And then the last one, shared hobbies. This just comes up more often than you might think, where people say, I really love wine and my partner doesn't drink. And how am I going to enjoy the vineyards with this person? And the point is that unless you're an Olympic athlete and you're doing your hobby all the time, you know, our hobbies are a small part of our lives. And as long as the person doesn't resent you for investing in something that they're not interested in, that's totally fine. Now, what does relationship science tell us matters more than we think? Those are things like kindness, loyalty, emotional stability, having a growth mindset, which, you know, this podcast, I think, is all about that, being able to make hard decisions together. And then the last one, which to me has really become the most important, is what side of you that person brings out. And someone might be listening and rolling their eyes and saying, yeah, obviously kindness and loyalty matter, but that's not what people come to me and say that they're looking for. That's not what people report on after a date. And I really want people to shift their mindset from looking out for those things. And there's a couple tips around this. So loyalty, what's a proxy for loyalty? Well, does this person help other people move? Does this person have friends from early stages of life? Is this person a fair weather friend who wants to be with the cool kids? And are they, you know, happy to talk to their depressed friend when they're going through a rough patch? Kindness, you know, how do they treat people who they don't want anything from? How do they tip? You know, do they walk through the world empathetically? emotional stability, you know, are they reactive to something happen and it sets them off, or do they respond? Do they actually take that space to really think about what they want to do? And as I said, I think the most important one is what side of you they bring out. And that's because that is who you will be in life if you choose this person. And if you find someone whose resume is exactly what you thought you were looking for, but ultimately they make you feel small, de-energized, bring you down, that why would you want to be that person? And so I'll finish this answer with one final tip, which is, if I said to you, who is the person in your life who makes you feel the best, who really energizes you? Let's call that person your penthouse person. They bring you up. Who's a person where consistently when you hang out with them, they bring you down, they make you feel small? That's your basement person. And what's interesting is oftentimes people's penthouse person is their best friend. And so instead of looking for the checklist, look for someone who makes you feel the way your best friend does. And after the date, you can ask yourself a bunch of questions, but, you know, was this a penthouse person? Was this a basement person? And that advice is true for romantic relationships and otherwise. Like, if you go to a job interview and everyone you interview with feels like a basement person, like, that's how it will feel at work. You will feel de-energized. And just tuning in and practicing that skill of paying attention to what side of you different situations and people bring out.
That's such a good point. And, it, you know, even though I'm not dating anymore, it really makes me think about relationships with everybody, right? Like, anytime you see, you have any kind of encounter, you do have that response to them. Like, are they a penthouse person or a basement person? It's kind of a great way to frame that.
Absolutely.
Now, we have a bunch of questions from listeners. Should we get started on them? Jordan, do you want to
Let's do it.
Want to do the first one?
Sure, absolutely. So one question from listeners, which is one that I really am interested in the answer to, about if you're starting to online date, how important is that initial message? Not necessarily in the long term of the relationship, maybe, but like, how much thought and time should someone put into that opening message? How much does that impact someone's chances of keeping the ball rolling?
Yeah, I love this question. And I wonder if you two remember that OkCupid used to have this blog called OK Trends. It was this big, it was kind of one of the early data science blogs where they would analyze people's behavior on OkCupid and then write about it. And then the founder of OkCupid, Christian Rutter, he wrote this great book, Dataclysm, where he summarized a lot of this. And so I have a feeling that some of this might come from that research, which he said, you know, you don't want to say, hey, you don't want to say hi, you want to stand out. And so they did this big data project about first messages and what to say and what not to say. And so I don't have Hinge research specifically on that, but I can tell you this, which is that on Hinge, you fill out a profile and you're answering prompt responses. And so one of my favorite prompts is my ideal plus one for a wedding. And then somebody fills it in. And so what I like to tell people is that your profile is actually your opening line. Because your profile is you putting yourself out there with a statement, and then somebody responds to that statement. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Hinge, you don't swipe right or left. You respond to a photo, you respond to a prompt. So let's say that the prompt is my ideal plus one for a wedding. And then the person writes, someone who's not married. Ha ha, you know, it's a joke. They're saying, I want to go to a wedding with someone single. But what am I really going to respond to that? How is that opening the conversation? Whereas if you write somebody who knows all the lyrics to the song Wannabe by the Spice Girls, you know, that's really painting a picture for me. Now I can message you about 90s music. I can write to you and say, who's going to sing the Scary Spice verse? Who's going to win in a 90s dance-off, right? There's all these things. And so your profile is the opening line. And my advice there is to be specific. People do this all the time. They write, I love cooking. Yeah, a lot of people love cooking. Tell me your signature dish. Tell me why you love to make your grandmother's marinara sauce. Tell me why your Vietnamese soup is phenomenal. I really want to know who you are so that I can respond. And so in conclusion, you know, be specific to spark conversation. Your opening line matters a lot because it helps you stand out. It helps you show that you put effort into it. And so both invest in your profile, and when you're responding to someone's profile, you don't want to use cliches. You want to show them that you put effort in and maybe recognize something that somebody else didn't. You know, this is just a small tip, but if you comment on something on the bottom of their profile, it's probably less common that someone else has responded to that. But in general, I would say great relationships oftentimes start with a great first message. And the first thing that you can do is be really specific and really thoughtful about what you're putting out there.
list you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's list is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Piggybacking off of Jordan's question, I was curious, are there any really like do's and don'ts about photos on apps?
Yeah, there absolutely are. And so one thing that I'll point to is that in working as a dating coach, I have helped so many people set up their profiles, and they make these mistakes that sometimes shock me. And so one thing is that sometimes people put off downloading the apps, and then by the time they download them, they're in a rush and they're saying, I'm finally going to do it. This is happening. And they're rushing to get to their matches as soon as possible. And so they just don't invest time in making a great profile. And that's just silly because this is the first impression, right? I said, this is your opening line. This is your, you know, your first chance to really present who you are. And so in working as a dating coach, when I saw people's photos, I would often say, you know, this is just not a flattering picture, or this is really low quality, or this is, you know, you're a very attractive person. This doesn't look like you. And so I'd give them this homework assignment. I'd say, make a Google Photos album and send me a bunch of pictures from your phone. And this was especially true for men, not to generalize, but it just seems like men have fewer good photos of themselves on their phone. And make this album for me. And now I'm going to send this to 5 people around the country who don't know you and will never meet you. And they are independently going to choose their favorite photos of you. And they're going to say what to include, what not to include, and then which is the single best photo. And we'll use that as your very important profile picture, the first picture. And interestingly, the photos were almost never what that person had chosen for themselves. And there was often consensus around that best photo. And so what you can do, you know, you can do this yourself. You can A/B test your profile, have different pictures as the first one and see what people respond. That's a little complicated. Why not just make an album and send it to some friends and say, which photo really captures who I am? And so step one is just choosing a really great first photo. I recommend a headshot, something that's, you know, not literally a work headshot, but something that shows your face, is clear, has good lighting, and someone can see what you look like. And then for the rest of the photos, use some variety. Don't use 3 photos from the same camping trip. Show one that shows your full body, one that shows you doing an activity you love. That's a great jumping off point for conversation. Maybe ones with friends and family. This helps people see that you are social. You do have people in your life. I mean, it's a bit of social proof. And then you want to have a mixture of silly and serious and things that show who you are. And a couple more do's and don'ts. There's some notorious photos that you should avoid. So there's the picture that was popular a few years ago, which is a person in Thailand with a sedated tiger. Throw that out the window. There's the photo of the guy holding up the fish. Cliche, get rid of it. And then there's photos that just obscure what you look like. So don't use a bathroom selfie that's low quality. Don't use a gym selfie. Don't use one with a filter or sunglasses. Don't include that bridesmaid photo where you're one of 20 girls wearing a peach dress and nobody knows which one is you. And really, this is you putting yourself forward. Help people understand who you are and what you look like.
Can we talk about the transition from communicating with someone online or via text and then meeting that person in person? And one of the things I think people struggle with is if I'm texting someone, for example, I could be fucking witty as all shit. I have time to respond. I don't like it's sort of like that cliche about dating where everyone's sort of meeting their, I think Chris Rock said, their representative, like you're meeting a version of someone else that's, you know, 10 or 20% better. Like when you're texting, you can be really clever. You can be really witty. You have a lot of time for your responses and you can sort of craft this persona. And that can be probably daunting for when you're meeting someone in real life and you feel that you can't really live up to that. Is there any sort of thoughts or advice for, you know, how to represent yourself over text so that you're being more genuine, or when you're meeting in person that you can sort of stay true to the person as witty as they were when they were texting, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Jordan, you'd be surprised how often texting comes up in dating coaching. It's interesting because you just don't think about it as a critical part of relationships. But so often, you know, a guy will say to me, I'm just a bad texter. And like, I really like this girl, but she doesn't get it. Or you know, I'm the type of person that puts my phone in my pocket all day and I don't respond, or
that drives me crazy.
Yeah. And then a guy will say, I'm dating this girl, but she's just so bad at texting. I feel like I couldn't be with her. She's like below the minimum threshold of what I needed. Just want to just, you know, sort of legitimize the question and say that texting comes up a lot. But in specifically in response to your question, I do have a strong opinion on that, which is that you need to get to the date as soon as possible. And people do this thing called pen palling, where they match on the app and they go back and forth and they keep talking. And in their mind, you know, oh, I want to get to know someone first. It's a safety thing. I want to warm up. But it's a mistake. And here's the reason why. I call this the Monet effect. So our brain has a natural tendency that when we get a blurry image of something, we fill in the gaps to make it more positive. And so let's say that Alice had on the app, I like music, and I match with her. I say, oh, I bet she likes the same music that I do. And I'm filling in the gaps to create this perfect image of her in my mind and building up this fantasy. And so I call it the Monet effect, of course, because Monet painted these beautiful pictures where from far away, you know, it looks gorgeous. And then, as they say in the movie Clueless, up close, it's a big old mess. And so you create this fantasy in your mind from far away. And so what ends up happening is, okay, so I've matched with Alice. I've created this fantasy of her in my mind. And then I meet her. And Alice is great and we would be a good match. But because I have a fantasy of her that she doesn't meet, I'm now disappointed. And so the longer you text, the more stories you make up in your mind, the more you're sure that they're this particular thing. And that actually puts you at a disadvantage. And so in general, I want people to think about dating apps as matchmaking machines, and it's just the chance to be introduced to someone, and that you shouldn't assume that their profile tells you too much. You shouldn't read too much into their texting. You should get to the date as soon as possible. And this is one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is the rise of video dating. And video dates are the new coffee date, and they are the chance to hop on FaceTime, see how things go with the other person, check out their vibe. It's low pressure. You don't have to buy them a $22 cocktail. You don't have to put on too much eyeliner. And, you know, just get a sense of your match. And so really my advice is to text less and talk sooner.
And so once you get to that date, what should your mindset be? Should you have specific goals and intentions about what you want to learn, or should you just go into it seeing what happens?
Yeah, I love this question. And really, through my research, I've discovered that mindset is everything. And whether you think the date will go well or you think the date will go poorly, you're right. And dating burnout is real. I have had dating coaching clients who say, I've been on a date every week for the last 52 weeks and I haven't met anyone. And what am I doing? And I'm saying, you know, yeah, you're showing up and you're putting the effort in, but it's not only the effort, it's the attitude. And I can tell just from being with you for 5 minutes that you're overdating, you're exhausted, you're showing up in a negative way. You have your arms folded with me right now. Everything I'm asking you, you're responding, but no. And you need to take a break and you need to actually get into a better mindset and go out there and date like that. So not only should some people take a break from dating, but you also want to get yourself into the right mindset before a date. And I recommend doing a pre-date ritual. And this might be taking a bath, calling your best friend, listening to your pump up playlist, riding your bike, something that transitions you from work mode to fresh, present date mode. And look, if you have a Zoom from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., don't hop on a Zoom date at 6:05. You're just going to show up like it's another work meeting, and you're going to be in that interview mindset. And so the next thing to do is to make dates fun. And to actually try to be playful. What can you do? Can you play an online game together? Can you go for a walk and each show each other on FaceTime your different neighborhoods? Can you, you know, tease each other a little bit? How can we make dates fun and sexy again? I mean, talk about fuck the spark. How are you going to have a spark if you're doing a 7 a.m. coffee date, which is a real thing that some of my clients have done before we work together? And then my last piece of advice here is to answer these questions after the date. I have a list of questions called the post-date eight. And they are things like, how did my body feel when I was talking to this person? Did I feel curious about them? What side of me did they bring out? And this is based on research on gratitude journals. So we know that when you have to write three things at the end of the day that you're grateful for, you are looking for those things all day, and it is training your brain to identify them more. And so you really say, wow, I was trying to catch the bus for work and I was able to catch it. And maybe before you wouldn't have noticed it. And so if you know at the end of the date, you have to answer those questions, then on the date, you're more present, you're tuned into your body, you're tuned into your emotions, and it helps you be more present and to shift from that evaluative mindset of, are you good enough for me and what's the checklist, to the experiential mindset of, how do I enjoy being around you?
The dates that you describe, you know, going on a walk and showing each other your neighborhood or playing an online game, like those are things that for me would be on the awesome end of the spectrum of things that I would enjoy doing. And far on the other end of the spectrum are interview dates. Like those dates where you're just asking each other questions and you're learning about each other by just telling each other the answer rather than seeing and sort of learning on your own. But since we're in a pandemic right now, like those are going to be maybe inevitable for some people. So if you do find yourself on a Zoom call with someone for a date, for a coffee date, you know, how can you steer the conversation or how could you maybe approach that to try to make it less of an interview date and something that's more organic or something that's more fun?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I just love that question. And I think this will hopefully be very helpful for people. So yeah, so you want to model what you want from the date. And so one trick that I do, and this is a Latin term, I'll probably get the pronunciation wrong, but in media res, and this is when a play starts in the middle of the action and then it rolls back and tells you the context. And that's a really great way of presenting drama in a movie or a play or a TV show, but it's actually a cool trick for dates. And so I do this all the time now, just naturally, where Jordan, let's say you and I were starting a Zoom call. I wouldn't just say, hey, where are you? I would say, oh my God, the craziest thing just happened. I was just parking my car and there was a bunny behind me. You know, obviously a true story, but I'm just starting like we're friends. I'm coming from a place of connection and I'm basically just saying, this is what happened to me right before we're here. And let me tell you where I'm at and let me tell you what's going on for me. And, you know, I'm disarming you. And suddenly we're just starting from a point of connection. We're not starting from this weird, icy cold where we have to inch towards each other. And so you can start a date that way. You can say, oh, let me tell you what happened at work today, and I'd love your opinion on it. Or my sister and I are having this debate. What do you think? And it disarms the person. And then you can reverse and you can eventually say, what part of New York do you live in? Oh, you know, how's the pandemic been? All that small talk, you know, you can either skip it or you can get to it later, but don't start that way. And so really you want to model the type of behavior that you're looking for. And so starting from an interesting place, sharing stories, asking someone for advice, basically treating them like a friend versus a stranger. That's helpful, whether it's networking or work calls or dating. I think that that really holds true. And then the other thing is just having an arsenal of good questions. So you might say, what's the weirdest purchase you made during the pandemic? What is the thing you are most looking forward to doing once people can travel again? And there's a concept called press play mode that my friend Kristen Berman came up with. She's a behavioral scientist who I used to work with. And this is the idea that, let's say I said to Alice, what is the Life Hacker podcast? How many times has she answered that? And she's just going to press play in her brain and say, Life Hacker podcast is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. She's not present. She's not thinking. She's repeating lines that she said. That's not fun for her, and those aren't fun answers. But if I said to her a question that she's never been asked before, you know, something like, what is the trait of your third grade teacher that really impacted you and stuck with you? Now she's actually thinking and she's in the moment and she's connecting dots and she's actually experiencing the date with me. She's not pressing play. And so, you know, take people out of press play mode by asking them interesting questions.
What about for those people, what advice would you say for people who are anti-online dating? Like they have this idea, maybe it's because they're looking for the spark where they're, you know, grabbing the tomato at the farmer's market at the same time, or they just expect it to be a lot of, you know, text message and pen paling back and forth or whatever their aversion is. Currently, do they have other options or do they need to bite the bullet and get online? Like what advice do we have for people who might not be interested in online dating?
Okay, so let's say it's February 2020 and you're asking me this question. I would have an answer for you about how to meet more people IRL in real life. And one of my favorite features of the book is this matrix called the Event Decision Matrix. And it's a way for meeting more people at events and figuring out what events to go to. And so basically you see all available events and you say, which ones would I enjoy? Which ones have a high likelihood of interaction? You plot them on this 2x2 matrix and you go to the events where you're likely to enjoy it, which brings out the best side of you, and you're likely to interact with people. So let's say a small dinner party versus, you know, going to a movie. And so there are some tips and tricks that you can do for meeting people in real life. Okay, but it's not February 2020. It's February 2021, and there aren't those events. It's not safe to meet up with people in person that way. And so we are in a different reality. And the truth is that I think the stigma of online dating has pretty much gone away. If you look at the New York Times marriage vows, so many couples meet online. If you look at the research from sociologist Michael J. Rosenfeld of Stanford, meeting online overtook meeting through friends and family and meeting at bars and restaurants a few years ago. So it's the number one way that people are connecting. And so just in general, I would say if you're holding it back because of the stigma, who cares? That's over with. The second thing I would say is, why are you anti-online dating? Is it because you're what I call the romanticizer, that person who's obsessed with the soulmate and the happily ever after and has an unrealistic expectation of relationships? Forget it. Who cares how you met, right? It's just this matchmaking machine. It's just a technique, a tool in your toolbox that you can use. And so I think these people are giving the dating apps, you know, more attention than they need. Just think about them as, this is the way that I meet people. I do my banking online. I track my sleep through my app, and I use a dating app to meet people. And, you know, don't turn it into this bigger thing than it is. And then the last thing I would say is just a lot of those people who have been holding out on online dating, they have joined the dating apps during the pandemic. And that's because it's really the only reliable and safe way to meet people. And so for them, I would just say, think of it as a matchmaking machine. Think about it as an efficient way to just figure out who's single and who's not, and give yourself a chance. And you get to determine how often you use it and in what way you use it. It's just a tool that's available to you.
So Logan, we're nearing the end of our time, but there's one more question I really wanted to ask you. It kind of spoke to my heart, but one of our readers asked, as a shorter man, I see the height requirements in profiles and know that I'm mostly being filtered out. Do you have any advice on how to increase this person's chances of meeting somebody who might be filtering him out, or should he not be meeting those people?
Oh man, wow, this is definitely a question I have a lot of hot takes on, so we might have to run over.
All right, that's okay.
I love a hot take. Okay, so first of all, this person is absolutely correct in that he's probably being filtered out. And so my mentor, Dan Ariely, did some incredible research on online dating a few years ago. He found that for a man who is 5'8", to be considered equally attractive to a man who is 5'9", that 5'8 man needs to make $40,000 more per year than the guy who's 5'9". And
that, you wait, just, I'm sorry,
yeah,
to interrupt.
Say it back
that's
to me,
one,
yeah.
The 1 inch is worth $40,000.
Yes. And so when you hear this, I don't want people to think that that's true in all aspects of life. That 5'8 guy at a bar does not need to make $40,000 more than the 5'9 guy at the bar. This has to do with specifically how information is presented on the dating apps. And so there's this concept that what measures is what matters. And merely by measuring something, we place more importance on it. So dating apps measure height. Height therefore becomes more important in the online dating market. Another thing is that when things are easily comparable, so it's easy to compare height 5'8 to 5'9 versus there's no kindness scale, then that also is something that we value more. And so he's correct that a lot of people are probably setting their height filters at 5'8", 5'9", 5'10", whatever it is, and that he's not being seen by them and he has to stand out. I have a friend who, I'm not sure that I can recommend this, but he's probably 5'6", 5'7", and he just felt like he wasn't seeing anyone on the apps. And so he set his height to 7 foot. And he purposely made it so high that he was like, look, I am a short Jewish man. They're going to see this in the photos. They're going to see that this is a joke. And he ended up seeing a lot of women who were over 6 feet tall, because those women are the type of people who set really high filters. He ended up dating a woman, I think she's around 5'11", They are in a super happy relationship. I think that they will get engaged. And, you know, he told her right away when they matched, this is the story. But he said, I just did this because I was being filtered out. And so I'm not recommending that people lie. And if everyone did that, then sort of what's the point of having these things? But I just really empathize with the story of this person. And I'll tell you one more thing, which is that I once swiped left on my husband on Tinder. And it was in 2014. And I knew him a little bit from college. We had had lunch once 7 years before, but I just saw him and I was like, nah, he looks unsmiling. He has a backwards hat. He looks like a bro, not my type. And I swiped left. We ended up meeting a few months later at a lunch at work. We both worked at Google. He started tutoring me in a coding language. And a year later, we started dating. And, you know, now we're married and we're very happy. And I say in the book, do you think I was looking for a 5'8 redheaded vegan engineer? No, that was not what I put on any checklist. But this is the person in the world who I love, who has made me happier than somebody else. And so honestly, I think maybe the sort of the closing thing is be humble, be open-minded about who will make you happiest long-term. And if you are that man or woman who has really strict age requirements or height requirements, you are filtering out some incredible people. And just, I want you to go into your app right now and expand your filters and just be more open-minded, because who cares about height? Who cares about age? You know, these things are just so arbitrary and they mean so many different things to different people, and so much more about the stuff that really matters, like what side of you they bring out.
Logan, thank you so much. This has really been great.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yay, thank you.
Now it's time for our upgrade of the week, where we talk about that one thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
So I got into, well, first of all, I should say, I'm well aware that I keep making my upgrades beverage related. And I'm not going to stop. This is going to be yet another beverage upgrade.
But you have a brand and you're going to stick to it.
I love a beverage. I mean, I've got like three glasses of things right in front of me right now. And I'm not ashamed.
Nice.
But I got into a real habit of having a glass of wine every night, which is like not the best habit to be in. Not that I was like drinking an entire bottle. I had like a glass, sometimes two glasses. I even bought smaller glasses so I wouldn't like, you know, have like a goblet of wine every night. But it didn't feel like a great thing to be doing during the pandemic. But I needed something, some way to like delineate the end of the workday. So I started making, inspired by Claire Lower's food article about dry January, I started making myself some mocktails. And
how are they?
They are delicious. Here's a secret I learned. Tart cherry juice, which is very good. Sparkling water, or seltzer, as we call it, New York. Soda pop. and some cherry bitters and a little squeeze of lime. It's delicious. And it makes you feel like you're having something special and sort of festive to end the day. And you're not...
Is it pretty quick to make? Like, how long does it take for you to make a mocktail?
It's like 10 seconds. Maybe not 10 seconds. Next time I'll time myself, but it's probably like 30 seconds, honestly. It's like pour a little bit of cherry juice in, pour a little bit of seltzer in. You need ice because otherwise, you know, what's a cocktail without ice? And some cherry bitters, you throw those in or any kind of, I mean, bitters are great. Do you have bitters, Jordan?
I don't. So the thing that would keep me from making fancy drinks for myself is I just automatically assume that it's time consuming or like takes more effort than what it sounds like. Like if it's quick and easy the way that you're describing, then I should make myself some more fancy drinks.
No, it's kind of nice to like make yourself a fancy drink just for the hell of it. Like if you have lime, you just put a little squeeze of lime juice and you put the lime on the side. It's a fancy
drink.
Seems
like a nice way to treat yourself.
I'm treating myself and I feel good about it.
I like it.
Jordan, what's your upgrade?
When I was trying to think of an upgrade, I was like, what have I been doing recently that's been sort of new? And I realized that pretty recently, I started scheduling out the TV shows that I'm going to watch or the movies that I'm going to watch. Like I started planning out my media in a way that, well, let me back up and explain the context of why I would even bother doing this. One thing that sort of starts to stress me out a little bit is the amount of content I am I want to consume. Like I try to read a lot. I try to keep up with movies. I try to keep up with certain TV shows. And it becomes like, you know, you're trying to outrun an avalanche of content. And I figured, you know, I want to organize it. And I started scheduling it out. Like tomorrow I'm going to watch this, you know, the next day, the next day, the next day. These are the things that I'm sort of scheduling out in my head. And sometimes I've actually put it on my calendar. And it's helped me feel less overwhelmed. I sort of have this vague calendar of things that I'm going to watch. On one hand, I feel like, oh, maybe this is structuring entertainment too much to the point that it's less entertaining. So that's something that I'm sort of grappling with. But that's sort of a compromise I've been willing to make recently to try to keep up with just the sheer amount of TV and movies and books that I've been trying to go through. So scheduling it out, that's what I've been doing.
I love it. And it's not like you're scheduling it out and you're like dreading it, right? It's like,
You're scheduling out treats for yourself. Rigid. Yeah. I don't want to be rigid about it and be like, no, you know, I scheduled Judas and like,
yeah, and I'm going to watch it.
Right. I'm going to watch it because I scheduled out, you know, this movie for this date, but I have planned it out in advance and it has made it, you know, like it's sort of the same comfort of making a list before bed where you just, don't have to think about it anymore. I don't have to like keep track of what it is I'm going to watch. I just sort of know that I've already written it down somewhere and that I'm going to watch it at a certain time.
I really love this idea. And I think I might at least start making a list because I find there's such an embarrassment of riches when it comes to TV and movies right now. And whenever somebody recommends something to me, I have this immediate feeling of like, not another one. Like I've got a list, but it's all in my head and I haven't written it out. I think I need to
Or you'll say like, oh yeah, I'm totally going to remember that. And then when you're scrolling around for something to watch, like, you know, it never comes to mind. Like with the amount of content out there, if you're the type of person who likes to keep up with it all, you really do need a list or some way to organize it or else you're just not going to remember it. And I don't know if this exists yet. If there is, it will be an upgrade one of these days when I discover it, which is a way to organize your shows across platforms. Like someone needs to create this if it doesn't exist already.
I don't know. I think this might be your invention. Your big app.
You know what? This is it.
I'm going to change everything.
I'm going to make millions.
And you're going to leave me.
Yeah.
God damn it.
All of a sudden, guys, when there's another co-host for the upgrade, then you'll know. Like Jordan made it.
And I'm just crying.
Just and now our upgrade of the week is...
How to work alone. And it's just me crying. All right. It's going to be fine. And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review too. You can also reach us by calling at 347-687-8109 and leaving us a voicemail. Or, of course, you can email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.